of Saints in the mid-60s because some doubt had arisen about whether or not she had actually lived. As if, in that wide-ranging anthology of stories that was the lives of the saints, that was, as well, my father's faith and Billy's, and some part of my own. What was actual, as opposed to what was imagined, as opposed to what was believed, made, when you got right down to it, any difference at all.
Now listen to an interview with the author.
My name is Matthew Thomas. I'm the author of We Are Not Ourselves, and I'm here to talk with Alice McDermott, one of the great living writers in English and my mentor when I was in grad school. It's an honor to be speaking with Alice today about Charming Billy, the book that made such a huge impact on letters in general and had quite an influence on younger writers, I would say, immediately upon its publication and since then for 20 years. I hope that everyone listening to this will experience the pleasure that I did years ago of meeting all these characters and falling into the lap of this family. One of the things I wanted to start by asking is the title, Charming Billy, as wonderful titles often do, does so much work. It works at the manifest level. Charming Billy, the Billy who is charming. It's also, of course, it suggests the idea of charming this Billy or an attempt to charm this Billy in one way or another. And we can talk about the ways in which that operates explicitly and thematically. But what struck me as very interesting is as much as this book is about Billy, there's also such a wonderful ensemble quality. And for so much of the book, we're not actually dealing with Billy. We're dealing with Holtzman and Sheila and Dennis and his relationship to his parents. And how much were you thinking of this as an ensemble production? And how much of it were you thinking of it as Billy's story particularly?
Mm-hmm. The idea for Charming Billy began with Billy, no question. As you know yourself, every story has a different genesis. Things that you think are inspiring on one hand end up not being so inspiring on the other hand. For me, Billy began this novel. And it was because I had dealt with an Irish-American community in At Weddings and Wakes, my third novel, and thought that would be the one and only novel I would ever deal with that community ever again. Did it, done, don't need to talk about them anymore. And then slowly, I was working actually on another book, and slowly I realized that there was a character from that community that had not made an appearance in At Weddings and Wakes. The lovable drunk, the guy who's drinking himself to death and yet is the life of every party, is full of affection for his friends and his family, is the stereotype of the ethnicity, the premier stereotype of Irish-American experience, the lovable drunk. And my immediate thought was, well, of course I didn't put that character in At Weddings and Wakes because he's such a stereotype, and it's such an ethnic cliche. You shouldn't write about such a character. And the contrarian in me immediately thought, well, then I'm going to.
thank God you did.
Well, so how can you do that? How can you write about such a character? The stereotype exists because these characters exist. There are lovable drunks in any extended Irish-American family. Since this book has come out, I found out that in every extended family, there are such lovable drunks. So it was really Billy that was the impetus for the story. But very quickly, I understood that, number one, he couldn't tell his own story. He would never tell it straight. He would lie. He would embellish. And the story could not be told about him if he was there to change it, to lie about it, to embellish. So I knew two things. It was his story, but he had to be dead. And his story had to be told by the people, the family and friends who had made his life as a lovable drunk possible. So yes, that idea of an ensemble, the idea of a novel that is essentially a story about storytelling and redeeming a life through storytelling, that I understood would be the approach.
What you say about how Billy couldn't have told his story because it would have been full of lies brings to mind something I wanted to ask you about, which is Gatsby. I've always thought that Gatsby, from Gatsby's point of view, would be a pretty atrocious book, of course, because it would be, you know, the story of how wonderful he is and all the wonderful things he's done. And, of course, Nick has to tell that story, but it is called The Great Gatsby. It's not called Nick Carraway. Gatsby, to me, hovers in the background of this book in so many ways. Of course, it's set on Long Island, and, of course, there's some sense in which the New York, the Arcadian New York, hovers at the background, even when we're not actually there. It may not be Arcadian for all these characters, but it happens to be there. But what's really fascinating is the longing that animates both of these books, Billy's longing for Eva, the presumption of this longing, and how it animates his life almost in the reverse way that Gatsby's life is animated. Gatsby builds an empire in order to win her back. Billy lives a life in some ways to avoid living because she couldn't have lived. Mm-hmm. And yet there is this sense of the dream, the American dream that plays out in this story. And it's explicitly referred to a couple of times in the book. If you want to see Gatsby's life as the pinnacle of such a dream, building something from nothing. Billy, in some ways, explicitly builds nothing from something. Uh-huh. And I wondered how much of Gatsby was on your mind in the writing of this book, and how much of the milieu of Long Island is shared with that book?
Well, certainly. I think being an American writer, having come of age at a time when English departments laid down the foundation of contemporary fiction with Faulkner, Fitzgerald, and Hemingway, I'm very much aware. Any time you're attempting to write, anyone of my generation attempting to write a novel that takes place on Long Island and in New York City, has Gatsby to tip a hat to, no question. And the romanticism. Of course, you know, initially, I think Fitzgerald intended Gatsby's Catholicism to play a role in the novel, which it ended up not doing. So maybe this was my attempt of reinserting the Catholicism into the American experience and the American dream. I mean, Gatsby's dream is of wealth. Billy's dream is of heaven.
Sure.
You know, is sure. Of that afterlife.
Yes.
You know, that green light at the end of the dock, mm-hmm. for him is eternity, mm-hmm. Which changes everything as far as I'm concerned. It changes the aspiration. It changes the romanticism. It changes any attitude about acquiring in this life. And I think that was something I was also very much aware of, that Billy and Dennis and these characters had to be of their socioeconomic, for lack of a more eloquent adjective, world, that they were not aspiring in the American way.
Mm-hmm.
They were aspiring in the Catholic way or the Christian way. Their eyes were on eternity.
Mm-hmm.
And wealth is almost amusing to them. The way they view the great mansions of at the end of Long Island are not with the same longing that Gatsby, not to acquire.
Mm-hmm.
They see it as lovely and they enjoy it and they love driving by them. But there's never a sense of how can I get one of those for myself? And that was really important to me, that this was not an American kind of striving. Was very much a Catholic American kind of striving.
They seem very aware of the power for family life to animate and motivate a happy existence. And in some ways, the dream they have is for everyone to be together on the weekend,
mm-hmm.
spending time together. And that's, of course, not the way Gatsby plays out. You know, these are people for whom family is only a secondary consideration a lot of the time. Do you think that, I mean, there's a conversation in the book about the four children that Billy may have had with her had she lived, of course, before we know that she did live. Is there a sense in which, had things worked out with them, he would have simply been happy to come home every day to his family? And is that ultimately, would you say that's the dream that's unfulfilled for him, is the simplest, quietest life possible?
Well, you know, Dennis contends that he would have found something to be unhappy about,
yeah.
no matter what.
Yeah.
And I think there's probably some wisdom in that. He wants the impossible.
Yeah.
And maybe this is where he's somewhat aligned with Gatsby. He wants the impossible. He wants life to be as beautiful as certain words can mm-hmm. make it seem. And there's a stubbornness about him to not give that up. And in some way, it's the thing that most of the characters are striving against. And I think it is, and you're absolutely right to point it out, that there is, it, within family, within that gathering, there is some sense of this is as much happiness as as we can achieve on Earth, because even in these gatherings, there will always be someone missing. There will always be a sense of mortality. If they're not missing yet, we know this may be the last time we're all out here on the island together. But in heaven, all that will be taken care of. That'll be fixed.
And in heaven, if there have been two spouses, one is ranked in order, right? We learned that in the book. The first marriage, of course, is given primacy. Right. How do these things get worked out later is for, I guess, God to figure out.
Exactly, right.
It's a fascinating ecosystem in a way. Reading the book again for this conversation, I was struck this time by how much writing Billy does. How many postcards he writes, how he finds a scrap of paper to write everywhere he goes. And it isn't suggested so much that he has literary aspirations, but it's suggested that he has a kind of magnanimity of soul that has to come out. He needs to communicate things to people. And they are, of course, people he loves, but what's interesting is he wants to communicate a sudden feeling he has about something, an observation, someone who reminded him of a friend or a relative on his trip to Ireland, for instance. That notion of his need to communicate, to me, suggests like the great largeness of his spirit and why it is that he will be missed so much. And that seems indomitable, despite his having lived a life that never, you know, fully coalesced around, let's say, his truest happiness, which would be to fully live, to be present for his family. There still remains in him something of a kind of joy. And there is a magnanimity that people at least retrospectively project onto him. Do you think of him, even despite the despair of his existence, greeting the world with this joy and a lack of the sin of despair, ultimately?
Yeah, I think what finally struck me about Billy is, and as you say, this great web of relationships. I suppose now he would be constantly texting, you know. In those days, it was sending postcards and being in touch. But despite that, I see in Billy, and I think maybe his cousin Dennis is the only one who also sees it, an extreme loneliness, an existential loneliness that others romanticize associated with the great heartache of his life, the big heartbreak that he experienced as a young man. But I think Dennis understands that it goes deeper than that and maybe is the source of the pain that they understand is what drives him to alcohol. But I think on Billy's part, there is a tremendous generosity, and he feels reaching out and connecting with people is more for them than it is for him.
Sure.
That it's not a selfish, stay by me, I need you.
Yeah.
It's a selfless, let me cheer you up, let me tell you a joke, let me tell you how happy I am to see you, to be here with you. He's one of those drunks who, as soon as he reaches a certain level, he's sure to tell you how much he loves you.
Sure.
but at the heart of that, I think, is all that goes unsaid and in Billy's life, and, you know, the lie that once he understands the truth, he still keeps to himself, not able to communicate with that web of fond friends and family.
Well, now that you've mentioned it, this opens up about 20 questions about that lie, all of which I think revolve around the same idea, which is, you know, why does he not say anything? And of course, how does he live afterward? Knowing what he knows, how did he live up until he knew what he knew? The question I have first is, once he knows the truth of that, why does he not share it with others? Is he protecting Dennis?
I think there's a good argument that could be made that's part of it. I think also, I do think he has an awareness of his role in this web of family and friends. And that there is a certain amount of projection going on that in his in his sacrificial romance, if you can put those two.
I was thinking the same thing.
If you can put those two words together.
Sure.
That he allows them to believe in the romance and sacrifices maybe the empathy or compassion that he might earn if he destroyed that romance. So, oh God, do we have a Christ figure?
Or certainly a priestly figure at the very least.
Right.
There is a priestly quality to his self-sacrifice in general. And what you were saying earlier about his magnanimity is for others, not for him, really gets at the idea of there being a quasi-priest-like quality to this character, that they need something from him. His ministrations are for them.
Yes.
Right? Is there any truth to Dennis's idea that he would really have been humiliated and he would have lost face had they all known that she had chosen, say, Tom over him? Do you believe that that would have really been a blow to their idea of him and to his idea of himself?
I guess my feeling is I have to take Dennis's word for it. Whether he's accurate or not is kind of beside the point. I think he believes it without question. I think he knows Billy's family and friends, because he's part of them as well as anyone. And is he absolutely right in that? I don't know. But I do understand his firm belief in it. And a lot of it is sort of trying to understand Billy and Dennis in the context of their generation, to be humiliated by a woman. Mm-hmm. In those years would have been far more emasculating than we may think about it right now. And so I think because he understands, or he's a product of that generation, that he understands how Billy would be diminished. And I don't think it's necessarily, that they would not be sympathetic, but it's the sympathy itself that Dennis is rejecting. You know, oh, poor Billy, she did this to him, is as bad as poor Billy, he's not good looking enough. So that sense of, in some way, securing his role as the charming young guy who this Irish woman fell madly in love with. Oh, and then it ended tragically. But he remains that charming man.
I think about the end of The Dead, when Greta talks to Gabriel about the dead Michael Fury. Michael Fury died for her, of course. And Gabriel is left with a feeling of never being able to live up to this, the legacy of this self-sacrifice. Now, Evette, of course, doesn't die for Billy in this formulation. She dies by accident. But, of course, until everyone knows the truth, there's the sense that no one could ever live up to her in his mind. But yet Maeve is there. And I'm fascinated by the idea that Maeve has the will to bear up under the overdetermined projections onto her that people make, that she carries such symbolic weight in everyone's mind as the sort of worldly concessions that he makes to simply living in the wake of this tragedy. How does she have the strength to walk around knowing that she, in some ways, is a living embodiment of everyone's projected ideas onto her?
Yeah. Well, I suppose if I think of Billy having this core of loneliness that isn't much demonstrated in his daily life, I think of Maeve having a core of tremendous strength that isn't much demonstrated in. I think in many ways she knows what she wants and she gets it.
She charms Billy.
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. Right. Yes. And I think, you know, her role as caretaker is empowering, if I can use a 21st century term that she would not have used herself. But I think that, I think, again, a woman of that generation, raised as she's been raised, within the strictures of this tight-knit, very Catholic, Irish-American family. This is how you get power. And I think, I don't think she would ever consciously plot that out. But I think she gets her rewards in that way. She's groomed for it through taking care of her father. But taking care of someone like that also sort of brings you to a confrontation with their helplessness if you're not there. And that can be very powerful for a woman in the confines of this society.
From that angle, Billy was the perfect partner for her to choose because she, of course, could do a ton of work on his behalf.
Right? Absolutely, yeah. And she gets him. I mean, it's you know, she manipulates. Goes after him.
One of the wonderful moments in the book is when we learn that she's thrown her father's shoes in the furnace in order to get him out there. Right. And the wonderful phrase, "for want of a shoe," right, which is part of that litany, that song. But, you know, for want of a shoe, their marriage emerges,
yes, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
And her father ultimately is a prop.
Yes.
In that scene, anyway.
Yes.
Does Billy essentially become, it's clear to connect the two, but does Billy, in a sense, become the vehicle through which she demonstrates her bona fides on the planet and her sort of faith and her, does he become the vehicle through which she establishes her goodness?
I think so. Yeah. And in some ways, they do become sort of partners in crime. She and Dennis end up in the same place, literally.
Yeah.
But also, there's that figurative. They are the two people at Billy's elbows. You know, if you've spent any time around people who drink too much, you know, one person can't support them if they're stumbling. You got to have someone at each elbow. It's sort of like rowing with one oar. You know, you have to have two people. They are the two people. And so in some ways, they both get the same benefits and sense of living a life that is valuable and beneficial, even if it's to this poor guy who's falling down. But I guess I also like to believe that over all this is, and there are plenty of faults in both of them, and plenty of egotism that both of them demonstrate in their relationships with Billy. But I think the thing that I felt I wanted to hold on to through the whole depiction of this community was that they're all doing the best they can. They are enablers, and they are romanticizing something awful, and this man is killing himself in their midst while they talk about that pretty Irish girl and try to romance. But I don't see it in any way as something that they should correct about themselves and be better people. I see it as they're doing the best they can for the people they love around them, Billy being primary.
It's even suggested that Sheila, Dennis's mother, at the end, preserves the house because of a notion that she, who we learn in the book, is the least sentimental person
yes,
alive,
yes.
A notion that she preserves somewhere in her mind that this might be keeping alive Billy's youthful idyll. And I was really touched by that reading at this time because I agree with you. I don't think there's anyone in this book who's motivated by, you know, malicious intentions whatsoever. What's fascinating is also the way that, despite that inherent goodness, we do get to see, because of the scrupulousness of your telling, the complexity of their personalities, of their souls, ultimately. And you don't stint on providing us, evidence if we want to convict them. And yet the book wonderfully refuses to convict anyone. And I think that's one of its great triumphs, is that it embraces these characters and their complexity, reserving judgment and allowing us to connect to their humanity in its full dress, right? So thank you for that. I want to ask you, do you think it would be possible for this plot to obtain in an era in which Billy may likely have seen a Facebook post about Eva a couple of months after her supposed death?
That ruins everything.
Yeah. How much of this book is ultimately, we know that it's set in a certain time, and you do a wonderful job of recreating the past at different intervals. How much of the plot of any book set before the onset of these contemporary technological advances is rooted in a kind of historical notion of human interaction?
I think probably not so much in particular to this story, but that sense of having and keeping secrets and having that interior life that is not accessible from the people around you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's true. And I had never, actually, I've not thought of it until now that Billy with an iPhone would be texting everyone all the time. Sure. He would be on Facebook. Sure. He would be liking everybody's everything, all nieces and nephews and cousins. But that interior world, I think, would remain as hidden as it was in his era. And in some ways, for a storyteller, mm-hmm. I think not having to negotiate the mm-hmm. way we communicate mm-hmm. so readily allows the believability of a silent interior life mm-hmm. To be conveyed. And yet I don't think that even with the speed and the vast ability we have to communicate, I don't think that in any way contradicts those silent interior lives that we all lead that are never shared or liked by anyone else.
Which is where Billy most resides, I
yes,
believe.
Yes, yes. And where fiction resides in many ways. I mean, you'll get it from a novel, but you're not going to get it from Facebook.
The novel is explicitly a second-person novel insofar as it is addressed to Matthew, to the offstage you, who the word you is used in that context only a few times mm-hmm. in the book. It's implicitly a first-person novel because it's a first-person speaker addressing the second-person speaker. Mm-hmm. But so much of it is told in the third person. And yet there is a feeling at the end of this book, particularly in the last couple of pages, of it really being a second-person novel with this offstage silent interlocutor. Mm-hmm. That's a fascinating formal choice, and I'm interested in it. And I'm interested in, you know, whether it struck you as a second-person book, even though it's so much of the time not.
Yeah, the voice of this novel was unique in some ways. I mean, it came into the novel, not with any planning on my part. As a matter of fact, I was very conscious of, I am so tired of first-person novels. Sure. Yeah. You know, at the time, I was getting everybody's first novel that had anything to do with New York, Catholicism, Irish, you know, that was on my doorstep every day. There was, and they were all first-person. And I really did have a conscious sense starting out that that this would be a third-person. And that voice immediately in the opening scene at the dinner after the funeral, my father sits at the other. And, oh, my gosh, I really tried mm-hmm. to get it out. Mm-hmm. No, that's mm-hmm. not the plan. Mm-hmm. But every time I took it out, I lost interest in the voice. Something fell away from me. And as I began to really understand what the story was going to be and what I was aiming for, well, right away I thought, okay, this is a story about storytelling, as mm-hmm. I was saying earlier. So there needs to be a storyteller. Mm-hmm. And there needs to be someone who didn't witness it but can sort of gather all the various tales that are told about Billy's life by various people. Someone who's removed, a generation removed, removed geographically. She doesn't live among this world anymore. It seemed to me, too, that it needed to be a female voice, because that's the role of women in these, and again, it's not just Irish American, but in these family gatherings, the men can be talking sports or Wall Street or the latest headline in the living room, but the women will be in the kitchen and they'll be talking about who's dating whom mm-hmm. and how's that marriage going. They mm-hmm. talk about the emotional lives. Mm-hmm. So I knew it had to be a female telling this story. And finally, I think I reconciled myself to that voice because it's a voice trying to explain, mm-hmm. which means there are various versions that she can offer. So she needed to be explaining it to someone.
She decides to be a storyteller, I believe, when she starts calling her father Dennis. And I find that fascinating because it, as an emotional choice, that's a complicated one, right?
Yes.
To call a parent by a first name is something I've never done in my life.
Right.
I think. And for an Irish person particularly, it's quite a difficult thing to
exactly.
imagine. So when she creates that little bit of a move between the characters, in this case her father and herself, it really allows her to become a novelist.
Absolutely.
And I kept noticing that his name was Dennis throughout because it did always strike me while reading it again as quite a charged decision for her to make about mm-hmm. her father. The fact that it's not my father throughout the book. Another thing that struck me in the storytelling at the beginning is that we see Maeve, I believe, at the very far end of a very long table, a table set for 49. Her lack of proximity to the conversation going on around about her mm-hmm. is crucial to this, to the, you know, the stagecraft there.
Absolutely.
How relevant is her removal in that specific scene, but more generally from everyone in the book whenever they're talking about her? Because it seems as they, you know, these are people whose emotional calibration is set fairly high, even if they don't actively seem that emotionally intelligent from moment to moment, they have a culturally indoctrinated notion of what's proper, and they're talking about Maeve a lot of the book, and it seems crucial that she can't hear it. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And I think there is that. I mean, the people who tell or begin to tell Billy's story know the young Billy, and I think and part of it is that we can call it endearing over politeness of the Irish American community that. This is the Billy of the romance. This is the Billy of gossip. That time he spent on Long Island, that Irish girl. That's the stuff they really want to talk about. But of course they understand it shouldn't be mentioned in front of the second, sure. the second love interest, the widow. So there's that simple cultural negotiation going on. And there's also the freedom that they have to make Billy something other than what he was for Maeve, because his life with Maeve is his life in decline. And they all know that. Those are his later years. Mm-hmm. Those are the Billy of the drunken phone calls in the middle of the night, mm-hmm. of the passed out on the lawn, of the found on the street. And if she's there and on the conversation, and again, it's much the same why I couldn't have Billy out of the grave mm-hmm. when I began the novel. If she's there, they would not be able to relish what really from the moment they gather for that dinner begins the retelling of Billy's life, the telling it to make a better story than what actually happened.
And that Billy of the later years, they constantly talk about as having the restraint never to mention Eva's name. So on some level, they are washing away much of the truth of that experience by asserting the primary fact that he had the great decency never yes. to think of her again,
right.
despite how much of his life suggests that he's constantly thinking about her.
Right, exactly.
There's much made of the idea that Maeve may now be beautiful at the beginning of the novel. Has she become more beautiful? It seems to be one of the questions that they're asking themselves. But also on another level, and this is where storytelling comes in, can we see her as beautiful? Can beauty be assigned to her? Because if it is assigned to her, then the story of Billy's life is not as much the tragedy mm-hmm. that we can project onto it. Mm-hmm. But it also did strike me that perhaps she is more beautiful now insofar as they understand, you know, her nobility, and they might actually be able to see something in her in his death that they weren't able to see before his death, because she was his handmaiden for much of his life, and now she's given full subjectivity in his departure. Would you agree with that?
Again, I think there's the cultural element that a woman in mourning is going to make everybody give her a second look than a woman just going about her daily business of taking care of her alcoholic husband. So I think in some ways the grief gives her a kind of romanticism that the people around her sort of translate into, well, maybe she's not as plain as mm-hmm. we thought mm-hmm. she was, because look, she's sad and mm-hmm. there's been suffering. And now we can consider the nobility of her mm-hmm. suffering mm-hmm. now that Billy is at rest mm-hmm. and in his grave. So again, it's that, I think, a well-intentioned, in some ways, seeing her as plain and not deserving of our imaginations mm-hmm. or our sympathy, because she is simply the mop-up crew. Mm-hmm. The real drama is going on with Billy, or went on with Billy's mm-hmm. past and the ramifications of that have led to this terrible state. But once he's gone, mm-hmm. again, it's the storytelling impulse to, mm-hmm. What about that character? You know, maybe there's more to her story than we realized.
She's beatified to some extent.
Oh, absolutely, right.
And then she winds up with Dennis. The last pages of the book tell us that they marry in 1991. And I love imagining the ways they found each other. Not, of course, only because they administered to Billy's last years and managed his decline together, but perhaps found something of a genuine love in that mutual effort. And you very gracefully suggest the possibility that there is an entirely different novel about the two of them and whether or not, you know, they might actually have found the love that had eluded them for a long time. It's not a requirement at the end of this book. I mean, I think the reader wants this to be the case. And you also very gracefully don't insist that it is the case. You suggest that it's possible that they're just together in their last years. But I like the idea of the multiplicity of possibilities at the end. And I wondered if you made the decision to have them marry because the novel insisted on it and it was just the logic of the book, or if it was an idea that you had that you were delighted by, or was it both?
Both, I think. Yeah, there seemed an inevitability about it. There seemed a rightness to it. Again, at that point, and you know this, when you're that deep in the weeds, rounding third, coming towards home, nearly finished, there is a sense that it's not your story. And that I am listening to this narrator. And she's not sure. She observes. I think that that last chapter actually begins with her writing from her father's point of view, her father waking in the bedroom in the house out in the Hamptons, and she sees through his eyes briefly and can't sustain it. You know, he still remains a puzzlement to her. Is he doing this out of obligation? Is he doing this out of guilt? When they spend time together, Dennis and Maeve, there are two ghosts in the room. Their past include the life, Billy's life, and Dennis's marriage. They will always be there. And yet to marry is to say, but we'll go on despite it. It's not to forget them. So I think for me, it was listening to the narrator at that point and understanding her relationship with her father and understanding that she cannot know. She makes the attempt to see through his eyes, to describe the waking and the sunlight, all the things that she knows from her own experience of being in that house. But then when it comes to, by the way, I'm going to marry Maeve, there is that unspoken heart of the man that remains a mystery.
And she tells us that at the very end of the book, the last lines of the book really get at the heart of that. What was actual as opposed to what was imagined, as opposed to what was believed, made, when you got right down to it, any difference at all, as if, which is the part right, that it left out, as if it mattered, as if it made any difference. It doesn't ultimately matter whether or not they're in love. It matters that the novel knew that they needed to marry, and that's what's wonderful about the end of the book. It's a symphony of characters and stories woven together, and there's a sense of just expert crafting, and as we head toward the end, there becomes this wonderful feeling of inevitability, not the kind of inevitability that snaps something together like a cheap lock, the way Nabokov talks about, you know, bad stories working, but this rich, fertile field of inevitability wherein it's just clear that they marry at the end, and the novel just very gracefully allows that reality to emerge. And reading it again this time, it struck me that those kinds of inevitabilities at the ends of books are the best ways books end. When we don't necessarily see it coming, but once we have heard what is happening, we realize, oh, of course, that was it. And it struck me, I imagined you in the moment of composition also seeing the novel sending up the truth of its own ending, and I imagine it was a beautiful moment.
Well, there is that sense. I mean, you look for that, not so much, as you say, to sort of solve the mystery or to find the clue that you've been searching for, but that sense of striking a note that suddenly reverberates back to maybe even the first line. I think that's what we're after. And as a reader, I agree with that. That's, you know, I find that in a novel and get, oh, yeah, you know, and then, damn, how'd they do that? But just that sense of everything mattered up until mm-hmm. this moment. And now, and I didn't always see, sort of like life, I didn't mm-hmm. always see. You know, Eudora Welty, in One Writer's Beginning, talks about, she uses that wonderful metaphor of the train ride, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. the train going around a curve. And it's only when you leave the curve and you look back, mm-hmm. you can see where you have come from. Mm. And I think that's the ideal that we hope for in literary art, in the completion of a novel.
This novel is full of so many wonderful details, so pointedly chosen, so particularly realized, and so much sensory information. It's just a pleasure to read. And the characters are briefly sketched in somehow in full humanity. And I noticed this time Kate, who is a very minor character. This novel is just full of minor characters that somehow get three-dimensionality. She's constantly reminding us of the pedigree of her, yes. her boys. And of course, what's fascinating about that is that there's a sublimated urge for her own ascendancy, her own subjectivity to come out. And we, in the poignancy of that character, who, if you treat her ungenerously as a reader, you think, well, here she is puffing herself up. Uh-huh. But really, it's sad. And you do such a great job of calibrating that this woman who, if we decided to, we could judge, we realize, as soon as we start judging her, we have to judge ourselves because there is a longing in her to be seen and heard. And she's got a rich husband and she's got a son that's gone to Regis. And yet yes. somehow she has been effaced from this yes. story in a way. And there are so many characters like that. I wondered, each of these minor characters, to use a word that I don't think actually applies here, gathered together in what I was calling at the beginning this ensemble feeling. Are you reminding yourself to bring them in at moments, or do they just emerge naturally in scenes out of the ether?
Well, they were present. And again, I think that goes back to what we were talking about earlier, that sense of it is this web, this community of family and friends that made Billy's life possible. You can't be the kind of drunk he was and live as long as he did without that. And the time frame of the novel, the present of the novel, is fairly brief. So that they were all gathered there, mm-hmm. and any time mm-hmm. they were gathered, mm-hmm. they were in the scene. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't so much that I had to keep notes about bring mm-hmm. them back, mm-hmm. but they were so there, mm-hmm. and they needed to be. And even Kate, and I mean, she's the Aspirer. I mean, she's mm-hmm. more Gatsby than she's far more Gatsby than Billy is. She's not thinking about heaven. She's thinking about yeah. redoing her house yeah. in Rye, yeah. And impressing people with her brilliant children. She wants the American dream. She doesn't want the Catholic dream. And so just the fact that she's there in the room, that again, this sort of dance, especially that the women do at a time of grief or a time of birth. First communion or confirmation, get this done, get that done. Somebody is in charge. She just would be part of that ensemble.
Reading the opening chapter again, and of course the conversations later at the home after the repast, I am struck by the way I kept thinking of the death of Ivan Ilyich. And in that novel, we hear Tolstoy ultimately really prosecuting the living for the ways they are attempting to own the story of the mm-hmm. dead. And there's a kind of grave indictment in that book. It's not satirical because Tolstoy's aim is far greater than satire. He's indicting humanity. And in this novel, what I love is that despite all the evidence that you provide for the venality of these characters at moments, their need to assert the primacy of their own presence, I was actually his best man, I know a thing or two about him. I own the story of Billy, despite how much of this is happening in a key that's not that dissimilar from the death of Ivan Ilyich. There doesn't feel like a prosecutorial impulse going mm-hmm. on in this book. And I'm really fascinated by that. I'm wondering if you can speak to the idea that, that there is no lack of marshalling of evidence against them, and yet it doesn't ultimately feel as if this is a story pursuing a criminal complaint.
Mm-hmm. Again, I think this is probably why that first person narrator entered the story, a sort of a mitigator. Someone who can observe but doesn't really have her life is affected by this world, very much so. but she doesn't have any money in this game. Billy was just one of these many cousins. And she's also her father's daughter. And that was sort of interesting for me to see develop. The more I knew Dennis, the more I understood the narrator. Because Dennis is also keen-eyed. And he can be sometimes cruel in his assessment and then immediately sees the other side of it. He wants to get angry and then he doesn't. He wants to be resentful and then he doesn't. You have to see the person. You have to understand. And so I think there's an inheritance going on there, in her reporting of what she sees. I think, again, someone of that generation would not be able to, sort of mitigate that venality, as you say, would be more invested in her own place in this story. The narrator's place in this story is certainly there, but it comes about almost inadvertently. So she does have an investment in it. It means something. She has witnessed some of it, but I think it also gives her a sense I'm watching this and I'm understanding these characters in a way they don't understand themselves or that their contemporaries don't understand them. I had someone say to me once about the narrator here that always amuses me, that he just didn't think a young woman would have that kind of wisdom and those observational skills to tell this story.
Has he ever met any novelist?
I did have to point out that, well, maybe I'm not a young woman, but her author happened, you know.
That's a breathtaking. You hear the craziest thing.
Isn't it? I mean, just, yeah, okay.
Wow. Well, as you, what you said about Dennis made me think about how he really is gimlet-eyed. He sees everything quite clearly. And, when she asks him whether he regretted the lie, he immediately says, essentially, I did.
Yeah.
And that's a big deal because not only Billy's life was affected, but the entire community rallied around this lie. One thing that struck me reading this again was what a burden it must have been for Dennis to carry this lie around. Do you think that burden marks his entire existence afterward?
Yeah, I think in some ways I think the tragic figure in this novel is Dennis. In some ways the lie was an impulse. And I don't think he ever believed he would pull it off as well as he did. But it's the thing that undermines his own faith.
Briefly.
Well, long enough for him. And when he loses Claire, when he loses his wife, the time when his faith should be providing him the comfort that nothing else can, because of that lie, it's not there for him.
Wow.
That one tenant of his faith that he most needs at that moment, that he has convinced her that he believes in, that he brings her through her illness, he brings her through her death. They've done till death do us part. They will meet again in heaven. She seemed to have believed that all through her dying. He told her he believed it all through her dying. But when she's gone, as he puts it gives him some trouble. Because he sees Billy's vivid faith in something that he's created that he knows is not true as parallel to his own religious faith. If Billy could be so wrong about something he believed so thoroughly, so can I.
This is making me realize what an extraordinarily Catholic novel this is. Billy as a knight of infinite resignation is a remarkably Catholic figure, and so is Dennis, as you're putting it, is the thing that Billy is seeking this entire existence long, redemption through suffering, as we would find in Dostoevsky. Or is this just, as you earlier put it, a longing for something extraordinary? How much of Billy can we understand as a Catholic figure looking for a spiritual quest of some kind?
Yeah, I don't, I don't think the Catholicism can be separated from this novel in any way. although I was once told that if you changed all the surnames and changed the alcohol to high cholesterol food, this was a portrait of a Jewish family. but there is, you know, that sense of, maybe it comes through Dennis's mother. It comes through Sheila most profoundly in the novel. Her sense of life is meaningless. You know, she looks at her son, who she loves, her only child, and thinks he's just an ordinary guy, and it's just going to be day after day after day. I think the term she uses is sort of like swinging from one Saturday to another, like a monkey in the zoo. What makes anybody special? What makes any life valuable? And of course, the answer for these Catholic characters is the redemption, is the glory and the beyond, is that love redeems us, makes us more than that, makes any ordinary life something spectacular. Ultimately, keep the faith, it'll happen. And I don't think Billy's worldview or Dennis's worldview could exist separate from that.
From one angle, is the lie the greatest thing Dennis could ever have done for Billy, in so far as it gave him a sense of greater purpose?
I don't think Dennis would see it that way. I think it really was trying to help out, trying to ease the way. And in some ways, Dennis does not romanticize Billy's alcoholism the way other people in the family do. And I think that's part of it. I think that is, as you say, his sort of gimlet eye, that something else is going on here with his drinking himself to death. And the story will not excuse it.
I believe it's Dennis who suggests that he might have been a drunk anyway, unless I'm mistaken.
Yes, yeah.
That's something I wanted to ask you about. It's a very simple explanation that many characters in the book give about his drinking, that it was Eva and everything goes back to her. And yet others in the book suggest that it's an illness and that he will suffer from it regardless, and that it's some kind of playing out of a sort of species level problem for the characters in the book. I don't know that you ever insist on it being one or the other in the book. And I think that's one of the great triumphs of the book, is that, you know, we don't have to know the answer. But you do such a wonderful job of suggesting that it could be both, that I was tempted to ask you what you thought, but I also decided I wouldn't do that. I just want to say it really does seem possible that Billy might have been a terrible drinker no matter what happens. And it also seems possible that this is the thing, the catalyzing moment for him. And that's to the book's great credit. About Dennis and his, and whatever guilt he feels, do you think it's possible that Billy's life, had he been told from the beginning that she hadn't died, would have been painful briefly and he would have rebuilt it? Or do you think it's inevitable, and setting aside the drinking for a second, do you think it's inevitable that he would have felt the crushing of his spirit because of her lack of love?
I think, and again, I think this is probably what I learned from listening to Dennis. I think Billy wanted what seems to everyone else in his realm the impossible. He didn't want an ordinary life. He would have had an ordinary life with the Irish girl or with Maeve. He wanted life to be beautiful, and alcohol made it look better for him. You know, was it in his DNA? Probably. Was it inevitable? Probably. But it was that insistence. It's really, Billy is the one who pushes against Sheila, Dennis's mother's belief that it's just one, we're all just one of a million. Makes no difference. Day after day, it makes no difference. You just go and you sit in your work, you do your job. You're not special. Nobody's special. And then you die. And I think that, you know, Billy just, that's part of Dennis's frustration and admiration. That moment that Billy has on the beach with those children, is not just, oh, maybe I could have children and move to the suburbs and have a two-car garage. None of those things. Mm-hmm. It's that life can be constantly and consistently as beautiful as we want to believe it is.
That calls to mind the way, certainly in the opening scene, many of the characters are willing to project onto the food, the memories of Billy, a kind of grace that may not be there. And in the telling, much of that impulse, generally in this community, is beautifully captured. It's suggested that a splash of juice on the meat is better than the gravy would have been. It's suggested that these canned peaches are leavened nicely by the sherbet that helps to wash them down. This feels very effortful on their parts to find in this meal a kind of grandeur. And that is both a beautiful impulse and a sad one.
Yes.
And that seems to get at the heart of what's happening with Billy generally. What do you think?
Absolutely, yeah. I think that is that striving for beauty. And the ordinary souls in this community say, but it's not going to happen. But there's reality, there's life, there's the day-to-day. And their sense of Billy as the one who said, I don't accept that. I don't accept that. No, if that's true, we should object and not accept. That's what elevates him among them. You know, that's why Danny Lynch says we should have just given him, fed him his drink and let him tell his story, let him talk about his pain, not just tell him move on and go on and be ordinary.
Well, he found the most wonderful narrator for him because she sees everything. She assimilates everything. She tells his story in his stead, and we are the great beneficiaries of that. Thank you for writing this beautiful book. Thank you for talking about it these many years later with such incredible clarity. It strikes me as possible that at the moment you remember as much about this as anybody could ever be expected to remember about a book
you
wrote that long ago. And thanks for your extraordinary gift of these characters to the world.
Well, same here, Matt. Thank you very much.
This is Barry Krynick. We hope you've enjoyed Charming Billy by Alice McDermott, a Macmillan audio production from Picador Books. This program was produced by Matty Argyropoulos. Text copyright 2018 by Alice McDermott. Production copyright 2018 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.